We're going to take a short musical break now, and when we come back, we're going to go into an addendum. We're going to read into the archives an addendum to an archive show that was done on March 6th of 1994. That archive show was entitled Strange Bedfellows. And what we're going to be looking into now are the fascist and intelligence connections of the late American extremist rabbi Meir Kahane, an individual with, as I like to say, more connections than a switchboard. Kahane, the Beit Harim, U.S. intelligence and international fascism, after a musical break. What we're going to do now is to incorporate an addendum into the archive. Specifically, we're going to tack on an addendum to the Strange Bedfellows archive show that was begun on March 6th of 1994. To briefly sum up the thrust of that archive show, we took a look in that program at the ideological mystification that fascism has engaged in. That is an ideological mystification that has permitted elements which not only from a practical standpoint should not be allied with fascism, but elements which, in fact, in their alliance with fascism, are allied with elements that are directly opposed to their own best interests. That ideological mystification has permitted such strange bedfellows as black separatist organizations, such as the Marcus Garvey Organization, Pan-Africa, the Nation of Islam under Elijah Muhammad, as well as the current Nation of Islam under Louis Farrakhan, to work with such organizations as the Ku Klux Klan, the American Nazi Party of George Lincoln Rockwell, and the Aryan Nations. Beyond that, that same ideological mystification has permitted groups that were fighting to gain their independence from their colonial masters, such as various Middle Eastern nationalist groups, Egyptian nationalists, Palestinian nationalists, and others, allied with Nazi Germany, hoping to gain independence from Great Britain. Of course, Nazi Germany most assuredly did not plan to have those elements being independent, at least not from a practical standpoint. They wanted them to be a part of the greater German alliance, so they could perhaps be nominally independent, like the Ustashi state in Croatia, but they would in fact be inextricably linked and subservient to the Third Reich. However, because of the ideological mystification of fascism, and also because of the anti-colonialist aims of many of those same groups, they wound up allied not only with fascism, but through fascism, in effect, wound up allied with elements of the Zionist movement, such as the Beit Harim under Vladimir Jabotinsky, that we looked at not only in the Strange Bedfellows archive show, but also in a miscellaneous archive show dealing with fascist Zionist connections. We also took a look at the alliances between the Stern Gang and fascist elements. The Stern Gang advocated a wartime alliance between Zionism and Nazi Germany in order to drive the British out of Palestine. We took a look in that broadcast at some of the similar views held by such diametrically opposed elements as the Nation of Islam in the United States, as exemplified by Khalid Muhammad, an individual whose political pronunciations would make Joseph Goebbels blush, and the supporters of Dr. Baruch Goldstein. That was the follower of Meir Kahane, the American-born extremist rabbi, who gunned down a number of Muslim men that were worshiping at the Mosque of the Patriarchs. That particular terrorist act, stylistically almost identical to the sorts of terrorist acts that Palestinian extremists have been engaging in, has not only endangered the Middle East peace process, but has precipitated a pattern of reciprocation from their counterparts in the Palestinian national movement. We have noted in numerous archive shows, including Radio Free America number 4, Radio Free America number 22, and the miscellaneous two-part archive show dealing with the fascist third position, that the more extreme elements of the Palestinian national movement have long been associated with fascism and explicitly with Nazism. We took a look at the followers of Haj Amin al-Husseini, the first leader of the Palestinian, the first significant leader of the Palestinian national movement. Haj Amin al-Husseini was a major in the SS, and he and his organization and their alliance with such Third Reich alumni as Otto Skorzeny and Gerhard Mertens have given rise to the more extreme elements of the Palestinian national movement, which maintain their Nazi connections to this day. And the person of such elements as Odfried Hepp and the Sportgruppe Hoffmann that we looked at in the Fascist Third Position Miscellaneous Archive Show, as well as Radio Free America number 32, a broadcast dealing with the Iran-Contra scandal. In the Strange Bedfellows archive show, I noted that the Amir Kahane organization was, ideologically at least, the direct successor to the Beitar organization, the fascist paramilitary organization, or the fascist-linked paramilitary organization of Vladimir Jabotinsky. I think Jabotinsky himself and large elements of his movement could be called explicitly fascist. The Beitar was extremist, reactionary, and paramilitary, although, as I've learned from research that I've conducted since, there were elements of the Beitar that would not be viewed as fascist, perhaps, per se, any more than the Marcus Garvey organization would be viewed as fascist. But certainly the Beitar organization had fascist elements within it, was allied with fascism, and the Beitar organization incorporated, among others, Meir Kahane. And Meir Kahane and some of his political soulmates, such as Joseph Cherba, an advisor on national security matters to the Ronald Reagan campaign in 1980, were not only affiliated with the Beitar, but they, in fact, represent a direct political succession as well as an ideological succession to the Beitar movement of Vladimir Jabotinsky. Jabotinsky himself, along with large elements of his movement, explicitly fascist. They were allied with Mussolini, among others. Research credit on the following long section of tonight's prepared broadcast goes to a listener. This listener copied long sections of a book entitled The False Prophet, subtitled Rabbi Meir Kahane from FBI Informant to Knesset Member. Of course, the Knesset, K-N-E-S-S-E-T, is the Israeli parliament. This book was authored by Robert I. Friedman, F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N, with a foreword by Christopher Hitchens, a well-known political columnist. And the book was copyrighted 1990 and published by Faber and Faber, with offices in both London and Boston. So once again, The False Prophet, subtitled Rabbi Meir Kahane from FBI Informant to Knesset Member, Robert I. Friedman, foreword by Christopher Hitchens, Faber and Faber, London and Boston, copyright 1990. What we're going to look at in this particular book are the profound political connections of Meir Kahane. Meir Kahane was not just the ideological successor to Vladimir Jabotinsky, the Beitar, and the fascist Zionists. He was directly connected to Vladimir Jabotinsky's organization. He was actually a member of the Beitar, and indeed Vladimir Jabotinsky himself was an honored guest at the Kahane home when Meir was a young boy. We're going to be taking a look at a number of important connections of the Meir Kahane organization and Kahane himself. There are a number of very important themes to take note of in this material. First of all, note the connections between Kahane himself and between his organization and the Beitar. Not only the Beitar of Vladimir Jabotinsky, but the Beitar of Jabotinsky's successors, such as Menachem Begin. Take note also of the profound connections, the inextricable connections, between Meir Kahane and his organization and U.S. intelligence, including elements of the American far right associated not only with the national security establishment, but explicitly the administration and campaign and or campaign of Ronald Reagan. Take note of the activities of Meir Kahane on behalf of the national security establishment, such as the activities undertaken by the Jewish Defense League against the Black Panther Party, which was pitting both the JDL and the Black Panther Party against each other. Well, these activities were undertaken on behalf of the FBI, which was deliberately pitting the Black Panther Party against the JDL, both of them extremist organizations, and two organizations which were ultimately used to harass, if not to actually destroy, each other. Note the extent to which the JDL functions on behalf of either U.S. intelligence and or the far right. Take note of the activities of the JDL in attempting to disrupt the campaign of the relatively progressive mayor of New York City, John Lindsay, an independent Republican who had forged a very effective ethnic coalition in New York City. Lindsay was very sympathetic to the rights of minorities, and the JDL was very active against the Lindsay campaign and was successful to a certain extent, at least, in poisoning the New York Jewish community against the relatively progressive mayor of New York, John Lindsay. Note also the activities of the JDL in attacking targets, Soviet targets inside of the United States. by way of attempting to force the Soviet Union to grant better treatment to its Jewish population or perhaps to allow them to emigrate to Israel. Note that those activities on behalf of the JDL were conducted in conjunction with elements in Israel that were the direct successor to the Beitar and the Stern Gang, and that they wound up threatening detente and, as such, served the interests of the American far right. We're also going to take a look at Meir Kahane's activities on behalf of U.S. intelligence in his relatively early days, attempting to drum up support for the Vietnam War movement, and also note the alliance between the Jewish Defense League and the Italian-American Civil Rights League that was founded and headed by New York mob boss Joseph Colombo Sr., later shot and killed. And note the comparison made between defenders of the Meir Kahane JDL-IACRL alliance. Those defenders compared the alliance between Joseph Colombo's organization and Meir Kahane's organization with the alliance between, surprise, surprise, Vladimir Jabotinsky and Mussolini. This, again, is going to be an addendum to the Strange Bedfellows archive show from March 6th. The first item we're going to look at is the close association between the family of Meir Kahane and Vladimir Jabotinsky himself, the head of the Beitar and the fascist element of the Zionist movement. Note again that the Zionist movement is far more pluralistic than it is generally represented as being. Some elements of it were explicitly fascist. Some elements of it were opposed to the fascist elements within it. Just like the Palestinian movement, national movement itself, has many elements, some of which were socialist, some of which, just like the Beitar and the Jewish Defense League, are associated with fascism. Indeed, the elements that are responding to the activities of Kahane, the act of Kahane supporter Baruch Goldstein, are themselves a direct successor to the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and the explicitly Nazi-allied elements of the Palestinian National Movement. We begin with our analysis and reading from The False Prophet by Robert Friedman, with the connections between, again, the Kahane family and Vladimir Jabotinsky, the head of the Beitar, the fascist element, which I should say incorporated the fascist element of the Zionist movement. The Beitar itself was reactionary and paramilitary. It would be incorrect to identify the entire Beitar as fascist, although it certainly was not an organization that I particularly agree with. But Jabotinsky himself was allied with Mussolini, and large elements of the Beitar were explicitly fascist. The Kahane-Jabotinsky connection as follows. When Meir was about four, the most controversial and possibly the most charismatic figure in Zionism, Zeev Vladimir Jabotinsky, appeared in his life for the first time. By the way, Jabotinsky's first name is Zeev, capital Z-E apostrophe E-V. Vladimir, of course, V-L-A-D-I-M-I-R. Jabotinsky, J-A-B-O-T-I-N-S-K-Y. Continuing. In March of 1940, he visited the Kahane house the day after delivering a spectacular marathon speech to an overflow crowd at the Manhattan Center, where he called for the founding of a Jewish army in Palestine that would fight alongside the Allies. Quote, "The next day, Jabotinsky showed up at our house," unquote, Sonia recalled, again quoting, "He walked over to my husband, and they conversed quietly. Then I heard my husband say, quote, 'Don't worry, I'll take care of the money,'" unquote. Jabotinsky stayed on for a brief time as a guest in the Kahane home. Note that the tune sounded here by Vladimir Jabotinsky of the raising of a Jewish army in Palestine to fight alongside the Allies was a relatively new tune. Previously, Vladimir Jabotinsky was allied with Benito Mussolini, and some of his organization were explicitly trained by at Mussolini's Naval Cadet School and reviewed by Mussolini himself. Jabotinsky, obviously an individual who would work with whatever sponsor he could find in order to create his reactionary paramilitary force. Continuing and skipping down. Of Jabotinsky, the author writes, by the way, it's noted here, although he was a highly cultivated liberal bourgeois intellectual, Jabotinsky was denounced by many Jews as a fascist. Ben-Gurion dubbed him Vladimir Hitler. As early as 1906, Jabotinsky had established a Jewish self-defense corps in Odessa. During the Arab riots of 1920, he organized a Jewish self-defense brigade in Jerusalem. In 1923, in Riga, Latvia, he established Beitar, capital B-E-T-A-R, an international paramilitary youth movement. He even founded a Jewish naval academy in southern Italy. Interrupting, that was the academy that was established under Mussolini's stewardship. Mussolini gave members of the Beitar military training, and Mussolini himself reviewed those. That information is contained in the miscellaneous archive show, Fascist Zionist Connections. Continuing. Yabotinsky enjoyed tremendous support among Eastern Europe's pogrom-plague Jews, who rallied to his call to form local Jewish military and police units for self-defense. Unavoidably, perhaps, his militaristic movement attracted a fair number of trigger-happy zealots, some of whom were drawn to Mussolini, and most of whom were opposed to the spirit of liberal democracy, which they felt had castrated Zionism. Continuing, and skipping down, what we're going to see next is the alliance between Meir Kahane and one of the individuals who was one of the most profound influences on his political career. That is a New York-born Jew of Syrian extraction named Joseph Churba, C-H-U-R-B-A, who was an intimate not only of the U.S. intelligence community, into which he introduced Meir Kahane, but Joseph Churba also was a senior policy advisor to Ronald Reagan and helped to advise Ronald Reagan on foreign affairs during the 1980 campaign. Of the Churba-Kahane alliance, Robert Friedman writes as follows. Sometime in 1963, Kahane removed his skullcap and prayer shawl and stepped into the world of covert action. Using the name Michael King, he began a research and intelligence gathering business with Joseph Churba, a childhood friend and fellow Betarnik. Note that both Churba and Meir Kahane were actually members of the Betar, the organization founded by Vladimir Yabotinsky. Continuing and skipping down. And who knows what might have become of Kahane if he hadn't teamed up with a lanky, dark-haired Churba. In 1963, Churba, then working on his doctorate at Columbia University, had already forged links with the CIA and Israeli intelligence, giving Kahane an entry to the shadowy world of spooks and prominent Cold Warriors. Although Churba went on to become a Middle East specialist for Air Force intelligence, a foreign affairs advisor to Ronald Reagan during the 1980 presidential campaign, and a senior policy advisor to the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, little is known about his early years. And Churba has assiduously worked to keep it that way. So note again, in the person of Joseph Churba, who had a profound influence on Meir Kahane, we are already seeing the connecting links between Meir Kahane and not only U.S. and Israeli intelligence, but also the American far-right and explicitly the elements of the American far-right and American fascism associated with the Ronald Reagan campaign and Ronald Reagan administrations. Skipping down. Joseph Churba and Meir Kahane went to the same schools, joined Betar, attended its summer camp in the Catskills, and later studied together at Yeshiva Mirer, M-I-R-R-E-R. So note again, Churba and Kahane actually members of the Betar, founded by Vladimir Yabotinsky. Skipping down. Churba currently heads the Center for International Security, an ultra-right-wing think tank in Washington founded by Reverend Sun Myung Moon's political arm, the Confederation of Associations for the Unity of the Societies of America, or CAUSA. Churba has refused repeated requests to speak about Kahane or himself. His silence is not surprising given his close relationship with the Reagan and Bush administrations. In any case, while Kahane was still tossing newspapers from his Austin two-seater in Laurelton, Churba was already in Washington, lobbying on behalf of the CIA-installed South Vietnamese puppet Ngo Dinh Diem, according to U.S. government sources. Sometime in early 1963, Churba introduced Kahane to Washington nightlife, front groups, and covert action. The possibility of infiltrating domestic extremist groups as well as the growing anti-war movement, perhaps even secretly aiding Israel, excited the failed rabbi. In a footnote to that passage, we reread, CAUSA was founded in 1980 by Bo-hee Pak, a former Korean CIA agent, and Kim Son-in, the former Korean CIA station chief in Mexico City. CAUSA's first executive director was Warren Richardson, formerly general counsel to the anti-Semitic Liberty Lobby. CAUSA's advisory board includes General George Keegan and Daniel Graham, former deputy director of the CIA. In 1985, Moon was imprisoned for 13 months in America for income tax evasion. His felony connection has not stopped him from having influence in the nation's capital through his newspaper, The Washington Times, and other organizations. Even though he is a strong supporter of Israel, Moon has been criticized by some Jewish leaders for attracting numerous young Jews to his cult-like Unification Church, which preaches a strange brew of Christianity, Confucianism, and anti-communism. A note among the associates of CAUSA, the the fellow was Warren, the first executive director, Warren Richardson, former general counsel to the Liberty Lobby, which is an organization which is about as far from any sort of pro-Jewish organization as you can possibly get. The Liberty Lobby, of course, is very closely linked with the Committee for the Institute for Historical Review, which basically denies that the Holocaust happened. They used to start their meetings with the Horst Wessel song, the official song of the German Nazi Party. Willis Carto, the founder of the Liberty Lobby, says, we were on the wrong side in World War II and blames World War II on the Jews. And note that Joseph Cherba is the head of the Center for International Security that was founded by Khalsa, whose first executive director was the former general counsel to the Liberty Lobby. That's why I term this particular archive show Strange Bedfellows. And the doctrinaire anti-communism and the ideological mystification that fascism engages in permits such disparate elements, or apparently disparate elements, as Joseph Cherba and Meyer Kahane to bed down very comfortably with the likes of Warren Richardson. Skipping down and continuing. But Kahane, whose skills in improvisation were already evident in high school, soon became adept at playing any number of roles. By his own account, he would spend much of the next 4 years leading a double life. He would leave his home in Laurelton on Monday for Washington or Manhattan and return for the Sabbath on Friday. He posed variously as a foreign correspondent, a college professor, and a well-to-do bachelor. He spent one summer in the Hamptons at Cherba's house. A New York public relations woman told the New York Times in 1971 that she remembered running into Kahane at a party on Long Island. Quote, "I knew him only as Michael King," she said, again quoting, "He told me he had been a correspondent for a wire service in Africa, and I recall at one point he volunteered that he was a Presbyterian," unquote. The closest Kahane ever came to being a foreign correspondent was delivering the New York Times in Laurelton. However, family and friends marveled at how well the former newspaper delivery boy seemed to be doing in his new life. "We knew Kahane was doing some projects for the government in Washington, but nobody knew exactly what," said Rabbi Romanek, R-O-M-I-N-E-K. So note that Joseph Cherba is the one who introduces Meyer Kahane to the intelligence milieu with which he would later work. One of the earliest Cherba-Kahane intelligence collaborations was a movement called the July 4th Movement, which was basically a U.S. intelligence front that was designed to drum up support on behalf of American college students for the Vietnam War. Robert Friedman writes about this in The False Prophet, describing it as follows. In the spring of 1965, Cherba and Kahane set up the July 4th Movement. According to Kahane, the organization tried to create cells on American college campuses to support the Vietnam War and to block the spread of the radical student left. Kahane later told me that their pro-Vietnam venture received seed money from the government and from, quote, certain groups within the labor movement, unquote, including the AFL-CIO under the leadership of George Meany. Cherba and Kahane also received support from legendary Cold Warriors Jay Lovestone and Irving Brown, who had been top officials of the American Communist Party in the 1920s before undergoing a Damascus Road conversion, and who subsequently ran the AFL-CIO's powerful International Affairs Department under the tutelage of the CIA. And in a footnote to that passage, we're going to go on still further about the July 4th Movement, Joseph Cherba, Meyer Kahane, Jay Lovestone, and Irving Brown. In a footnote to that passage, we find the following. Thanks to Brown, by 1953, his key contact in the Marseille underworld, Pierre Ferry Pisani, had control of the city's port where he built an international heroin trafficking empire. This was not the first time that American intelligence purchased the services of the mafia. Prior to the Allied invasion of Sicily in the Second World War, the OSS established contacts with the Sicilian mafia through the same Lucky Luciano who allowed Beitar to smuggle weapons from Hoboken to the Irgun in Palestine. The Sicilian mafia provided intelligence on the Germans and after the war assassinated hundreds of Italian left-wing political activists. CIA agent Miles Copeland later boasted, quote, "Had it not been for mafia, the communists would by now be in control of Italy," unquote. If the covert backing of wholesale political assassinations and tolerance for heroin dealers bothered Irving Brown, he never let on. Quote, "Why shouldn't covert action be acceptable in peacetime to try and prevent the possibility of war," unquote, Brown said in a 1977 speech. Now more about the Cherba, Kahane, Lovestone, Brown collaboration in the July 4th Movement. Friedman writes, It was under the CIA's direction that Lovestone and Brown, using a Corsican and Italian mafiosos, I think it should have been mafiosi, set up right-wing death squads in Marseille and other European cities after the Second World War to break the burgeoning left-wing labor movement. In an article entitled, I'm Glad the CIA is Immortal, which appeared in the Saturday Evening Post in May 1967, Thomas Braden, who headed the CIA's clandestine services in Western Europe in the early 1950s, wrote that it was his idea to, quote, to give $15,000 to Irving Brown to pay off his strong-arm squads in Mediterranean ports so that American supplies could be unloaded against the opposition of communist dock workers. Brown's success in France led to similar CIA-funded campaigns of subversion against trade union movements elsewhere in Europe and the Third World. Quote, when they, the AFL-CIO, ran out of money, they appealed to the CIA, wrote Braden, until recently the co-host of cable news network's Crossfire. Thus began the secret subsidy of free trade unions. By the mid-1960s, the AFL-CIO was busy propping up South Vietnam's trade union movement as part of the war effort. Quote, I visited South Vietnam to work with trade unionists quite often, Irving Brown told me shortly before he died in Paris in February of 1989. Brown said that he and Lovestone supported the July 4th movement because, quote, we liked their position of Vietnam. I think it means the position on Vietnam. It's a misprint here. According to Irving Brown's son, Robert, who worked with the movement, his father introduced Kahane and Cherba to wealthy conservatives as well as to heads of individual labor unions like Mike Sampson, president of the Con Ed local in New York, who contributed $5,000 to the July 4th movement from the union's political slush fund. Robert Brown was 23 when he first met Cherba and Kahane in 1965 at his father's office, where the two spelled out the goals of their group. He recalls that Kahane, who went by the name of Michael King, quote, appeared to be the more forceful of the two, a little too glib, a little too slick, unquote. Nevertheless, like his father, Robert was impressed with their plan to build a student movement on college campuses that would support the Vietnam War. Quote, their presentation was fantastic, said Robert Brown, again quoting, there was a screaming need for a student organization that would support the war. Remember, this was the spring of 1965. The 1st Marine Unit had arrived in Da Nang, and President Johnson had raised the draft. King generated a certain sense of urgency and a desire for action, which was very appealing to us. Finally, somebody on the right wanted to do something. Cherba and Kahane were certainly fortunate to meet Irving Brown and Jay Lovestone. The pair dominated the government's post-war policies toward the international labor movement. The men themselves were part of a vast network of former communists turned hard-right CIA assets who were dedicated to waging a no-holds-barred war against Soviet aggression. Quote, my father saved Western Europe, unquote, said Robert Brown, again quoting, every time I drink good French wine, I thank my father. And of the AFL-CIO's of the CIA's labor movement activity, in another asterisk passage, we find the operation was run by the CIA through Brown. By the way, this is the AFL-CIO's collaboration with the CIA. The operation was run to the CIA by Brown, then director of the International Confederation of Trade Unions, or ICFTU, an international trade union movement dominated by the AFL-CIO. According to former CIA agent Philip Agee, the ICFTU was, quote, set up and controlled by the CIA, unquote, and the, quote, principal CIA agent for control of the ICFTU was Brown. Now, returning to the main body of the text, imagine what it meant for Cherba. Let me reread part of this so we can pick up the thread of the discussion. Cherba and Kahane were certainly fortunate to meet Irving Brown and Jay Lovestone. The pair dominated the government's post-war policies towards the international labor movement. The men themselves were part of a vast network of former communists turned hard-right CIA assets who were dedicated to waging a no-holds-barred war against Soviet aggression. Quote, my father saved Western Europe, said Robert Brown. Every time I drink good French wine, I thank my father. Imagine what it meant for Cherba and King to meet my father. They thought they were going to have it made, unquote. The July 4th movement read at an office near Union Square in Manhattan. On June 29, 1965, a quarter-page advertisement appeared in the New York Herald Tribune announcing the formation of the organization. It was signed by Joseph Cherba, chairman, and Michael King, director. Robert Brown and his childhood friend Roy Godson, then a graduate student in political science at Columbia University, became the group's student directors. Godson's father, Joseph, a close friend of both Irving Brown and Jay Lovestone, had been a labor attaché in the U.S. Embassy in London during the 1950s. Some 20 years after meeting Kahane, Roy Godson, by then a National Security Council consultant and a close friend of the late CIA chief William Casey, drew the attention of congressional committees investigating the Iran-Contra scandal for his role as middleman in a complex series of financial transactions to provide funds to Nicaraguan opposition groups at the behest of the Reagan White House. So again, note that in addition to people like Joseph Cherba, a U.S. intelligence asset and advisor to Ronald Reagan, in addition to associating with longtime CIA assets and activists like Irving Brown and Jay Lovestone, we find Kahane associating with people like Roy Godson, another luminary of the American far right, a member of the Reagan administration, specifically an individual involved with generating support for the Contras. Some 20 years after meeting, resuming the discussion, some 20 years after meeting Kahane, Roy Godson, Robert Brown and his childhood friend Roy Godson, then a graduate student in political science at Columbia University, became the group's student directors. Godson's father, Joseph, a close friend of both Irving Brown and Jay Lovestone, had been a labor attaché in the U.S. Embassy in London during the 1950s. Some 20 years after meeting Kahane, Roy Godson, by then a National Security Council consultant and a close friend of the late CIA chief William Casey, drew the attention of congressional committees investigating the Iran-Contra scandal for his role as middleman in a complex series of financial transactions to provide funds to Nicaraguan opposition groups at the behest of the Reagan White House. As early as 1983, the late Senator Edward Zirinsky of Nebraska had called for an investigation of Godson for allegedly using youth organizations and international youth exchanges for covert intelligence gathering. Now, note again that Roy Godson was an individual who lent his support to the July 4th movement of Kahane, Cherba, Lovestone, and Brown. Continuing, Godson's hardline anti-communist views and his penchant for using front groups was already evident when he teamed up with Kahane and Cherba. Godson told me he joined the July 4th movement to help, quote, counteract the communist-dominated student movements then prevalent on college campuses. And in a footnote to that passage, we find the following. Joseph Godson owed his job to Lovestone, who, as head of the International Labor Division of the AFL-CIO, handpicked virtually every major labor attaché post at U.S. embassies. After Joseph Godson retired from U.S. government service, he set up the London offices of the Labor Committee for Transatlantic Understanding and Georgetown University's Center for Strategic and International Studies. And another footnote, a self-styled expert on Soviet groups and on Soviet front groups and disinformation techniques, Godson has apparently become involved in the funding of right-wing organizations in Europe and America. According to a U.S. government memo released during the Iran-Contra hearings, quote, Roy Godson reported that he met earlier this week with a group of private donors that Charlie Wick brought to the Situation Room 2 months ago. The group made their first commitment of $400,000, which includes support to Freedom House, a pro-INF group in Holland, Accuracy in Media, an ultra-right-wing media watchdog group in the U.S., and a European-based labor program, quite possibly the Labor Committee for Transatlantic Understanding, whose London office his late father headed. And skipping down, before we move on to the next passage, so note again that with the July 4th movement, we are once again seeing the deepening involvement of Meyer Kahane with A, U.S. intelligence in the person of the CIA and CIA-associated individuals. We are also seeing Meyer Kahane moving deeper into the ranks of the American far right, and in particular with people who figured prominently in the history of the Cold War, such as Irving Brown and Jay Lovestone. And beyond that, we're seeing in the person of people like Joseph Cherba and Roy Godson, people that were deeply and very closely affiliated not only with American fascism, but explicitly with the Reagan and Bush administrations. What we're going to look at next is a brief passage concerning Meyer Kahane's testimony before the House Un-American Activities Committee. This was arranged by a fellow named Herbert Romerstein, who, as we shall see, was working as an expert on Soviet disinformation. Well, I'll read you the passage here. Kahane's testimony, that's before the House Un-American Activities Committee, Kahane's testimony was arranged by Herbert Romerstein, HUAC's investigator in New York. Like Irving Brown and Jay Lovestone, Romerstein had been an official of the American Communist Party before undergoing a conversion to militant anti-communism. While Romerstein worked at the United States Information Agency as an expert on Soviet disinformation in the 1980s, the agency set up the International Youth Year Commission, which it used as a conduit for funding the Contras. A leader of the commission was none other than, you guessed it, Roy Godson. By the way, the "you guessed it" was my interjection. That's not in the text. So note again the milieu in which Meir Kahane was operating. U.S. intelligence, the American far right, including explicitly fascist elements associated, and explicitly fascist elements such as the Unification Church, as well as elements associated with the Reagan and Bush administrations, the Roy Godsons, the Joseph Cherbas, et al. And of course, the House Un-American Activities Committee, notorious for its anti-communist witch hunts. Skipping down, once again, more about Kahane and HUAC. And also, we are going to see a transition here of Meir Kahane's activities, now explicitly associated with the JDL, the Jewish Defense League. And we're going to take a look at Meir Kahane's activities against militant black organizations. In addition to HUAC, Kahane also pulled in finance support from Cherba's hawkish friends in the intelligence community, an invisible government that operates in the shadows, cloaked behind the blanket of national security that allows it to hide from the public and Congress. Cherba himself was instrumental in helping the JDL get off the ground. Certainly, the JDL was not unlike the other front groups that Cherba and Kahane had set up to promote issues dear to the government. Quote, unlike the July 4th movement, however, the JDL took hold, said Zweibon, Z-W-E-I-B-O-N. The JDL had an impact on campus. Again, quoting rather, the JDL had an impact on campus. It turned many left-wing Jewish students to the right, and it helped to counteract the left and blacks. The government's cause was served, unquote. For a time, that is. By 1970, the JDL was running amok like Frankenstein's monster, nearly wrecking detente. We're going to look at that a little later. Quote, we picked the wrong man, unquote, to head the JDL, Cherba later told a former JDL official. Another indication that the militant Jewish group may initially have been sanctioned by an arm of the government. Note again, quote, we picked the wrong man to head the JDL, Cherba later told a former JDL official. Another indication that the militant Jewish group may initially have been sanctioned as an arm of the government. At noon on August 5, 1968, the JDL staged its first demonstration. It was held at New York University to protest against the hiring of John F. Hatchett, H-A-T-C-H-E-T-T, who had been selected to head the Martin Luther King Jr. Afro-American Student Center. Several months before his appointment, Hatchett had earned the enmity of some Jews for writing an article in the African-American Teachers Forum in which he claimed Jews, quote, dominate and control, unquote, New York schools, again quoting, where black children were mentally poisoned. This spells death for the minds and souls of our black children, unquote. Kahane and 12 followers picketed NYU for about an hour, chanting, quote, no Nazis at NYU. Jewish rights are precious, too, unquote. The following day, the demonstration made the morning papers, including the New York Times, which, over the next few years, eagerly covered the JDL's adventures, giving visibility to the movement. The JDL staged several other highly publicized demonstrations to protest against, quote, black anti-Semitism, unquote, following its march on NYU. And again, we're now going to begin looking at the activities of the JDL and its activities in particular on behalf of the FBI in opposing the Black Panther Party. And note again the observation made by Robert Friedman that there are firm indications that the JDL may actually have been, its founding may have been sanctioned by a branch, by the government itself. Certainly, Meir Kahane's milieu involves, as we have seen, not only elements associated with U.S. intelligence and the CIA, and as we're going to see here later, the FBI, but elements associated with such fascist organizations as the Reverend Moon and also the Liberty Lobby. And we're going to take a look, too, what we have seen, and we will see again, the connections between the Meir Kahane, his milieu, and people associated with the Reagan and Bush administrations. Continuing. A September 22, 1969 memo from G.C. Moore, M-O-O-R-E, head of Division 5, the FBI's Racial Intelligence Section, to the Bureau's number 2 man, W.C. Sullivan, requested that the New York office be permitted to use the JDL against the Panthers. It began, quote, attached is a letter authorizing the New York office to mail an anonymous communication purportedly from the father of a black extremist to a leader of a Jewish group called the Jewish Defense League. This communication seeks to establish a relationship between the sender and JEDEL for the purpose of furnishing JEDEL with instances of anti-Semitism by the Black Panther Party and other extremist groups. JEDL is a Jewish vigilante-type organization formed and operated in New York City. Its aims and purposes are to protect Jewish people from all sorts of anti-Semitism. At this time, its aims and purposes are not of an illegal nature and apparently not political. The Black Panther Party, as well as other extremist groups, are anti-Semitic in nature. Many instances of anti-Semitism by the Black Panther Party have been noted. This information, when placed in the hands of JEDL, could easily operate against the best interests of the BPP with resultant disruption. So again, we're noting here the Jewish Defense League operating on behalf of the FBI in the COINTELPRO program. Continuing, this is still from this internal FBI memo. JEDEL is apparently financially well off and has access to newspaper coverage. It is our intent to create a fictitious source of information who will furnish public source data to Rabbi Meir Kahane. It is expected that the information will ultimately be published and cause embarrassment to the Black Panther Party and other extremist groups. New York had proposed the mailing of an anonymous letter from a pro-Jewish Negro father of a Black Panther Party member. The letter is addressed to Rabbi Kahane and professes sympathy and friendship for the Jews and criticism of the Black Panther Party. It leaves the way open for additional communications. Recommendation: that attached letter granting New York authority to mail the suggested communication be approved and forwarded. This letter ensures that strict security be maintained and the communication be prepared on commercially purchased paper and envelope. Then returning to the main text. Setting extremist groups against each other like gladiators in ancient Rome was a tried and true FBI tactic. Hoover must have loved the idea of using Kahane to attack the Panthers, whom he once called, quote, the greatest threat to the internal security of the country, unquote. Soon, the FBI began to send the JDL leader, quote, reports, unquote, about the Panthers' alleged anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist activities. Kahane promptly regurgitated the FBI's, quote, facts, unquote, in his Jewish press column, Spotlight on Extremism, unquote, which became a clearinghouse for the fecund minds at Division 5. Ironically, at the same time as Kahane was dutifully publishing exposés on extremist groups, he began to receive threatening letters, ostensibly from Black extremists, but actually written by federal agents. One such letter sent to Kahane declared, quote, "We will get you one by one. Israel will have to be destroyed. Too much Jewish political power now. In the future, it will be Black power." Signed, "The New Era Black Boys," unquote. The FBI was playing a dangerous game. The JDL was no match for the street-tough Panthers. Nevertheless, on May 5, 1970, Kahane announced at a press conference that the Jewish Defense League was going to stage an armed demonstration against the New York Black Panther Party on its own turf in Harlem. Founded in Oakland in 1966, the Black Panther Party was composed of slum-bred, self-styled revolutionaries who called for the overthrow of quote, the racist white power structure in America, unquote. Unlike white student radicals, the Panthers not only carried guns, but also used them, sometimes with deadly effect. Quote, "The Panthers called me about the reported JDL demonstration," unquote, called Jerry Lefcourt, L-E-F-C-O-U-R-T, I'm not sure about the pronunciation, a prominent New York lawyer who represented the Panthers, quote, "and I just begged them to let it go. The Panthers wanted to rip them apart. I had all I could do to protect the JDL," unquote. The Bureau's continuing with the main text, the Bureau's blackbaiting nearly turned into a tragedy when, on an overcast spring morning on May 7, 1970, a rented Hertz truck loaded with chains, sticks, and nunchucks, two wooden sticks joined together by a chain, pulled up in front of the Black Panther Party headquarters on 123rd Street and Lenox Avenue. About 35 uniformed and beret young JDL members piled out of the vehicle, unfurling a 5-foot banner bearing the league's logo, a clenched fist thrust through a Star of David. Quote, "We jumped out of the vehicle and stood facing Panther headquarters, arms folded with a grim look on our faces," unquote, recalled former JDL member Arnie Bieber, B-E-I-B-E-R, who added that Kahane had pumped them up by constantly comparing the Panthers to Nazis.